We can go back now to Matthew chapter 16 and pick up again the theme that we've been looking at over the past few weeks, the theme of Jesus' resurrection. I've been trying to look at it from the point of view of a historian who is looking at the evidence and who is coming to conclusions on the basis of the evidence. And I hope that we've seen that the evidence for the resurrection is very compelling. We're just going to do that one more time today, and then we'll spend a few weeks looking at what it means for us since Jesus is risen from the dead. But if we look at Matthew 16 and we look at what the disciples are saying there when they're confronted with the possibility of Jesus actually dying and of Jesus rising. So Matthew 16 and verse 21, Jesus is explaining to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. And what we read then is that Peter took Jesus aside and rebuked him, and this is what he says, never, he says, never, never, no way, never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. And yet, a short time later, you know, a matter of months later, where we read in Acts 3, this same Peter, who's saying, you'll never die, Lord, it's not going to happen to you, is the same Peter who's saying, the scripture says Jesus had to die. He did die. You killed him, but God raised him from the dead. And we are witnesses of this. A tremendous change in the thinking of a person. How did it happen? How did this change come about? How did Peter go from saying never to saying it had to be? How does he change in that radical way? Things do change. Let's just imagine for a minute that you were all keen film buffs, and that last Sunday you stayed up late into the wee small hours of Monday morning to watch the Oscars. I don't suppose any of you did that. Maybe you did. I don't know if there's any really keen on these things. So let's imagine you stayed up to watch the Oscars and you're beginning to get a bit tired. You think, well, I'll watch until I see what the best picture was and then I'll go to bed. So you stay up and you finally get to the point where Warren Beatty opens the envelope and has a wee look at it and a wee sort of look around and seems to be playfully bringing the audience along with him. Then he hands the contents of the envelope, the card, to Faye Dunaway, and she reads out La La Land. And you think, okay, well, no surprises there. La La Land's the best picture. You switch the telly off and you go to bed. Next morning you get up, switch on the telly again, and they're saying best picture was awarded to Moonlight. You think, no, it wasn't. I saw it myself. The best picture was awarded to La La Land. How can that be? How can something change so much overnight? What happened? What was the strange event that brought that about? What was the strange event that brought about Peter's change of mind? How do you explain it? What's the missing link? That's the question. So you've got these two verses that we looked at. We've got Matthew 16:22, Peter saying, no way, Lord, will you die. And you think, okay, Peter's not for Jesus dying. And then a few months later, you've got the same Peter standing up and saying, it says in the scriptures, he had to die, and he did die. So what changed? What's the missing link? Let's elaborate on it a wee bit more, because although it's written all through the Gospels, it's sometimes easy to miss. The disciples did not think that Jesus would suffer and die, because their upbringing was such that they had indoctrinated into them from the very beginning of their lives that the Messiah was coming, and that when he came, he wouldn't suffer and die. he would live forever. And not only that, he would lead the nation of Israel to greatness again. They would conquer and destroy the Roman enemies who were occupying, and Israel's throne, the throne of David, would be established again. The Messiah would sit on the throne, and Israel would enter into a period of world domination, a period of great peace, the kingdom of the Messiah, and then at the end of time, God would raise up all the faithful to share in the blessings of that kingdom. And the disciples in the Gospels believe that, and they believe that they're onto a good thing, because Jesus is, they believe, the Messiah. And so if they hang around with him, it'll be a good thing for them. They will get the top jobs. And you can see them jostling for those jobs. They're arguing who's the greatest, and can we sit at the right and the left, and so on. They're looking for the top jobs. And as far as this business of resurrection is concerned, it's not in their minds at all, because it's not going to happen until the very end of the world. And also in their minds, anyone that claims to be a Messiah, and there are a few in the first century that come along and lead attempted revolutions against the Romans, but anyone who claims to be a Messiah who then is killed clearly wasn't the Messiah, but was an imposter. And this is what the disciples think. So they come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Messiah. He teaches in the way that no one else does. His character is so flawless, and his power is so evident. He's a miracle worker. They go with him, they follow him, but there's just one fly in the ointment as far as they're concerned, and that is that he starts to talk about dying. And every time he does, they say, well, that doesn't work. That's not what Messiah is about. That's not what the Messiah does. And like we read here in Matthew 16, they take him aside and say, get back on script, Jesus. This is not what Messiah does. Messiah lives forever. You will never die. And that's what they're saying. And they're doing this from this time on that we read of in Acts 16, in Matthew 16, right through to Holy Week, the week before Jesus is actually crucified. And they're still arguing about who's going to have the top jobs in Jesus' cabinet and so on. They're self-centered. There's glory in it for them, and they're looking forward to it. But then if you jump forward a few weeks from Holy Week, a few weeks, you come to Pentecost and the church after that, and it's all different. As we read in Acts 3, verse 18, suddenly, instead of saying, never, Lord, they're proclaiming, Jesus has died. Not only that, he had to die. That's what our scripture said he had to do. And now he has died. And the chief priests and the rulers have indeed made him suffer and die. And wherever they go, they explain this to their fellow Jews. Look, I know what you think about Messiah. You think he's going to live forever and lead a political revolution. It's not like that. Look at the scriptures. He's got to die. And he did. But now they're proclaiming that he's not only died, but he's alive. And he's ready to give salvation to any who come to God through him. What's happened to change their minds? It's a radical, radical way of thinking. What's happened to change? What happened from the night before to the morning after in the Oscars? Well, there was a most bizarre, as we saw, a most bizarre mix-up of envelopes and a most bizarre misunderstanding. What was it then that changed the disciples' minds from the before to the after, from what you think you know happened, that it's all over, Jesus is dead and it's finished, and he obviously wasn't the Messiah because Messiahs don't die, to Jesus had to die, and Jesus was the Messiah and he did die, and it said he would die, but now he's alive again. What happened to bring about that radical change? Now, we've already over the last few weeks, tried some explanations of what happened to bring about that change. We've looked at the possibility of Jesus maybe not actually dying at all, but just swooning and recovering in the cool of the tomb. We looked at the possibility that the disciples didn't really see him physically alive, but just had mass hallucinations. We looked at the possibility of the church making up the stories later on, somehow coming to believe that Jesus was risen and making up stories about it even when he wasn't. And there are lots of other explanations. There's the one in Matthew 28, the conspiracy theory. They pay the soldiers to put round the story that the body of Jesus was stolen by the disciples. But if you look at all of these, as we've done, you realise there isn't any way that any of these either could have happened or that they could explain what did happen and the change that came about from Jesus dying to the church beginning with such dynamism and energy declaring him alive. So what did happen? And if we want to find out, we go, like historians do, and ask the people who saw and who heard and who were there and who were witnesses. And we saw that the New Testament is full of witnesses to the story. And these are not just like one witness telling the same story. There are lots of different witnesses, all looking at it from different angles, all being brought together later. The people that wrote the Gospels and that wrote the letters, they're all proclaiming what happened, and they're all doing it from their own perspective. They're doing it like true witnesses, like people who really saw something amazing happen. So we ask them, so okay, what do you say accounts for the change? Jesus is dead on a cross, but now everyone's telling us he's alive. How did it happen? And the witnesses say this, well, look, you got to believe us. We struggled with what happened. It's not like we were gullible or credulous and we were just ready to believe anything. We doubted what we saw with our own eyes at first. We couldn't take it in. Because we believed that Messiah wouldn't die. We believed Messiah would lead the world into and lead our nation into a great time of peace, and where all the enemies would be suppressed and where God's kingdom would come in. But in the end, we had to ditch our whole world view, our whole way of thinking about how God would bring in his kingdom. Our whole understanding of what God's program was for the world, we had to get rid of it. Because the one we thought was Messiah died. And just when we're ready to conclude that he couldn't therefore have been the Messiah, he was alive again. God raised him from the dead with a new kind of physical body. And we saw him, we spent time with him, we touched him, he ate with us, he taught us again, we saw him ascend to heaven. That's why we changed. We changed because God did something completely unexpected, something we said never to. It won't happen. It can't happen. It's not like that. It's not going to be like that. We changed because when we were saying that, God did what we thought wouldn't happen. God did the thing that we said never to. Jesus died on a cross, and then God raised him from the dead. Now for us, it's probably difficult to appreciate how great a change that was for the disciples. Because actually, we've been brought up knowing that Jesus did die on a cross and did rise again. And because that was drummed into us, we don't really appreciate what a dramatic change of thinking the disciples had to go through. But it was dramatic. It was from saying never to saying it must be this way. And the only way to explain it is the way that the people to whom it happened explain it that God really did raise his son, Jesus Christ, from the dead. Do you accept that? Do you accept this conclusion? Do I accept this conclusion? Well, let's just think for a few more minutes then about the two options. Let's imagine that you don't accept the conclusion that God raised his son from the dead. And then we'll think about what happens if you do. If you don't accept the conclusion that God raised his son from the dead, but nevertheless, if you are following what we've been thinking about over the last few weeks, and if you are someone who has a grasp of the historical material relating to the early church, the Gospels, the Book of Acts, the letters, if you're someone who knows the material and who has looked at the arguments to try and explain why the church went from seeing their Messiah crucified and finished on a cross to then declaring that their Messiah was risen and alive and going out and telling the world that, if you followed the arguments and you realise that the way that people try and account for that change with the swoon theory or the hallucination theory or the disciples stole the body theory or whatever, and you've realised that all these arguments just don't work, what are you left with? Because that is the situation that many historians of ancient history are in. There are people all over the world that study this. They don't study it from a Christian point of view, they study it from an ancient history point of view. They study the sources, they study the primary witnesses, and they study the context, and they study everything they can about the time, and they realise that something happened. There was some mysterious X that fits into where the before meets the after. Something happened that changed the disciples from having this kind of political revolutionary Messiah idea and having that be absolutely dashed to pieces by the death of Jesus. And then, next thing, they're declaring him alive and that he had to die, and they're devoting their lives to sharing the good news that he is risen, that God raised him from the dead. What is the X, the mysterious X? If you can't accept what the witnesses say, that actually God did raise his son, and you really know the historic material and you think about it, you may end up having to go to desperate lengths to account for what happened. One of the people I've been reading and listening to actually more to help me to think about this is a fellow called William Lane Craig. And he is a Christian man, he's a philosopher and a teacher who spends a lot of time in universities debating with atheists, debating with skeptics about the Christian faith. And this is what he says about one particular encounter. He says, a few years ago I had a debate at the University of California on the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. It was with a professor who had written his doctoral dissertation on the evidence for the resurrection. He was completely familiar with the evidence, and he could not deny the fact of Jesus' honourable burial, the empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. Okay, so he's not denying the basics. He's not denying that Jesus was buried, that the tomb was then empty, that he appeared to the disciples, and that the disciples then subsequently believed he was risen. But this man was an atheist. This man was a skeptic. This man didn't believe the Christian faith. And yet he accepts Jesus was buried, then the tomb was empty, then he appears to his disciples, and then the disciples come to believe that he's therefore risen from the dead. But he can't accept that Jesus really is risen from the dead. So he's got a problem. So what William Lane Craig says is this. His only recourse was to come up with some alternative explanation of the facts. So he argued that Jesus of Nazareth must have had an unknown, identical twin brother who was separated from him at birth, unknown to his parents, who then came back to Jerusalem just at the time of the crucifixion, stole the body out of the tomb, then presented himself to the disciples, who mistakenly inferred that Jesus was risen from the dead. So, now get this, because it's really important to appreciate what's happening here. This is not like, you know, you're someone that's kind of blogging on the web, you know, just their own rants and kind of opinions about life. This is a professor at a university who's done a doctoral dissertation on the resurrection, but he can't believe the resurrection. He can't believe that it actually happened. But he knows that from his historical studies, Jesus did die, the tomb was empty, the disciples did believe they were seeing him again, and came to believe, therefore, that he was risen. And he's got to find a way to explain that. And he's looked at the hallucination theory and all the rest of it, and he realizes that none of these theories work. But because he can't accept the resurrection did happen, he comes up with this incredibly unbelievable and unlikely theory of this identical twin brother, and of this identical twin brother through an incredible series of unlikely circumstances, managing to present himself as Jesus risen from the dead. And it's laughable. Except this is what people have to do. But this guy is, you see, someone who knows the material. You know, if you go down the street in Plockton, you might just meet someone, oh, Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Don't even believe that Jesus existed, people will say. Well, these are people that don't know the material. They don't know what they're talking about. Because there's hardly anyone at all that studies ancient history that would say to you, Jesus didn't exist. Hardly anyone that would study it and say that something incredible happened. They would say something happened that changed the disciples from saying never to saying, yeah, Jesus did die. It had to happen. And we believe he's risen from the dead. The people that know the material know something happened, but they just can't explain it. But why would you avoid the obvious? Why would you? Why would you dismiss what the people who were there say happened? Well, of course, the reason you would dismiss it is because of what we call presuppositions. That you just can't believe that a dead person can live again, or you can't believe that miracles happen, or you can't believe that there's a God who does these things, or whatever. But if you just come to the material and say, well, the historic facts are Jesus died on a cross, and then Jesus was seen again afterwards, and the witnesses are all saying, yeah, he was raised from the dead, then perhaps we should accept that. Why say never? Why say never, Lord? Well, the reason why people do say never is for this reason, I think. A Jesus who is risen is a Jesus we're not finished with yet. A Jesus who's risen is a Jesus we're not finished with yet. A Jesus who's risen is a Jesus who's coming again. We're going to meet him. As we read in the funeral on Friday from John 14, I will come again. A Jesus who's risen is a Jesus we've got to meet. A Jesus whose judgment seat we have to appear before. And it's in order to try and avoid that conclusion, it's in order to try and avoid having to face that, that people will go into all kinds of contortions and distortions in order to avoid that conclusion. They don't want it. But I hope up to this point in this series, what we've done is to show that there's nowhere to hide. We have to face this risen Jesus. And given that he is risen, we should seek now to be at peace with him and to know his mercy, to be ready for his coming and our meeting with him. We know what the mysterious X is, what the missing link is, what the unexpected thing that happened that explains the change in the disciples is. We know that it's because God raised Jesus from the dead. That's why the disciples changed. That's why they became people who, far from thinking that Jesus had failed because he was dead, became convinced of a new reality, that the Messiah had to die for sins, and that God raised him from the dead, and that he is indeed now alive forevermore, and that he is coming again to establish his kingdom. We can't get rid of him. People tried. The chief priests and the rulers and the teachers of the law and the Romans and so on, they tried. They crucified him. But we can't. He doesn't go away because God raised him from the dead, and we can't make him go away either. What we can do is get ready to meet him. And to get ready to meet him, we must not say never. We must never say never, and we must ask God's forgiveness if we have said never, and we must accept God raised him from the dead and seek peace with Jesus. Seek peace with him in prayer. Seek his mercy until we know that we have it for ourselves. And that is what God is calling you and me to do in our lives, so that we will be ready for this Jesus we're not finished with yet, because he is risen from the dead. Amen.